in the 1950s, there was another, let's say, an AI, probably it was rather a robot wave, robot hype that was ongoing back then. People thought that, okay, really, really soon we are going to have these household robots that will do everything for us at home. But that didn't really happen. But what did happen instead was that we got washing machines. And after that, you didn't have to do your laundry manually. Anyway, that was a huge thing. And now if you look around in your home, you don't have those sort of like do-it-all robots, but rather what you have a dishwasher, you have a microwave, you have a toaster, you have a blender. There's so many different appliances you have at home. And all of them are really specialized in one single individual use case. And why is that? It's simply because it would be prohibitively expensive to design, build, manufacture, and so on, a singular machine that could actually do it all. And the same goes for AI.
Hi, and welcome to Inference, an AI business podcast by Silo AI. I'm Ville Hulkko, co-founder of Silo, the largest private AI lab from the Nordics that focuses on building human-centric AI for businesses. With the Inference podcast, we introduce a number of topics and people of the global AI scene that every business decision maker should know. With me today is Dr. Niko Vuokko. Niko is the Chief Technology Officer of Silo AI, leading Silo's technology strategy and IP. Prior to his work at Silo AI, Niko has led technology at pioneering data companies such as Sharper Shape, Eniram, and Metrify. A PhD by background, Niko is also a medalist in Mathematics Olympics, as well as the national team coach for over a decade. Niko, it's a privilege to have you with us. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Ville, and good to be here.
So, Niko, you're a well-known figure in the Nordic AI scene, at least to those who actively follow the AI discussion, but probably fewer people know about your background in itself. So, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, you sort of told already part of that. I think overall, it's for me, life has been sort of a transition from like a totally theoretical mindset to pretty far to the totally other end. So started a mathematician. It was fun. I was good at it. So I just started doing that. But then it is sort of a combination of questioning, is this actually valuable? What's going to come out of this? And then the question that, okay, there's been research on math for ages, whereas in computer science, machine learning, it is still like really, really starting up. And so that's why I sort of like shifted away from math, went to doing data science for my PhD. Then I did after that, I've sort of always been working somehow with machine learning. There's never been really a time when that hasn't been part of the picture. But like I was starting with technical aspect, just like, okay, let's do like really smart algorithms, let's put them running and see what we get. But then over time, it's always been a transition a bit more towards, okay, what does this actually mean? How do you actually turn this into something valuable? So then over time, at some point, I sort of shifted to doing product management around machine learning things. And then while doing that, I was sort of like, I was pulled into doing quite a bit of business development, and then I really liked it. And then I sort of ended up actually running that business development in the previous company. So I still liked it. So it has really become an increasing part of the stuff I do. And I think overall, thinking about what I do actually now at Silo, it's much more actually closely related to leading sort of like product management type of activities and helping out on the business development rather than doing some type of like raw technical topics as such. But it's often, you know, like especially whenever you have a B2B business and when it's so tied up with this sort of like up and coming new complex technology, then you can't really do those topics without having a pretty deep technical understanding behind you. So it's still like highly relevant background. So in a way, while I'm not really sort of like aiming to get back to the research days of my life, I still do read. I actually have a few articles waiting in my browser to be read, since they're like, but based on other blogs who actually read much more papers and just write about a few of those more interesting ones. That those sounded like actually quite impactful. So want to understand where things are going there still. So that's pretty much how it goes right now.
Yeah, so if we draw a Venn diagram of Nico Vuokko, there's the theoretical technology side, then there's the product management side, and then there's the commercial side, and in the middle, there you are. Getting into the topic, today we'll be discussing 2023 from AI's perspective. So over the past years, like AI adoption, as we know, has steadily progressed across like organizational adoption. And now, I guess, in the end of 2022, with the latest phenomena in the public space, like with ChatGPT and generative toolkits becoming more mainstream, like something that the consumers are now taking a steadier look at. But if we focus our gaze on kind of at least at Silo, how we divide the core technologies being classical machine learning, being computer vision and natural language processing. From your perspective, what is the status quo now on these technologies? Where are we as 2022 is come to a close and 23 is quickly kicking off?
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of different opinions here. And the picture is quite different if you think about it from like an academic researcher viewpoint or like a commercial application developer viewpoint. Overall, we have pretty strong ties to a lot of universities. I know quite a bit of like machine learning professors personally, like just talking about the matters once in a while, and pretty often I'm just saying to them that it wouldn't really matter if you just go on a vacation for the next 20 years in the academia, because there's been so much so valuable AI research coming out during just the past decade that it would take ages. It would at least take a few decades for the humanity to actually implement all the use cases, all the applications that we could actually already do with what we know right now. So there's been a huge explosion in the research lately, and the curious thing is that we're still in an acceleration phase. But it's not like all the different areas of research are equal. So maybe like if you get started with like computer vision, which is probably, let's say, the most mature of these areas, that overall computer vision, when it comes to practical use cases and the magnitude of those use cases, then actually computer vision is really already pretty mature. It's just like extremely productive and reliable technology. Sort of like in really many cases where you have good data from which you could reasonably assume to be able to achieve a certain algorithm, certain solution, and solve that use case, put that into real world running, then over there you can actually do that. You can be pretty sure that that will actually succeed. And so when you're there, you think of the challenges remaining. They're not so much about scientific questions. While there's quite a bit of things you can optimize and do better and so on, but in the end, the core big questions in the computer vision science have sort of been solved at this point. And it's much more a question of engineering. How do you turn that science into something practical? And especially, how do you turn that science into something that you can efficiently scale into really, really big scale, where you're running huge data sets, streaming through sensors all over to real-time running models, and probably then even outrunning multiple models from the same data and still having them reliably working together and providing a consistent understanding of the world, it sees. So that's sort of like those sort of questions remain there. But other than that, it's definitely the most mature area. then if you think about like maybe others, I think usually it's been like natural language processing, NLP is another one. And then like reinforcement learning is probably the third interesting area. Well, NLP, it's like, well, as you might expect, it's really hitting the top of the hype curve right now. There's this is like really an argument that goes both ways. So mostly as it's been so many times previously, mostly the understanding of what the broader public has about the capabilities of these latest like breakthrough AI models, as you mentioned, there's way too many expectations on what they are able to achieve. So the hype is overselling the capabilities by a really, really big margin. But then again, at the same time, it's a totally wrong idea to somehow discount these achievements. So even if the expectations of what you can achieve with it right now, they are way overblown, but still the progress that we've made has been like really supernatural in its level. Like right now, what the models are doing, what like ChatGPT or DALL-E or other models like this, what they are achieving is so much more than we thought that could be possible in several decades, if you just go back like 5 years or so. So let's like overall, the progress has been a surprise, or even to the scientific community. So pretty often there in research, you can see that, okay, this is the way to go. We can see that this idea scales. We will get there. We will achieve these things. But even then, I think the time scale, how quickly we've gotten to the objective there is been a big surprise. So right now, like with natural language, it's much more a question of scaling data sets, like where do you get actually more data? We are pretty close to the point where it's just hard to get more text data in your hand so that you get better and bigger models available. There's actually projections written on when are we going to hit that wall, and it's going to be a pretty interesting challenge for us overall. Like, okay, what do we do when there's just no more data to dump into this big machine that does something with it? Maybe the second biggest challenge, which is sort of like when you're reading about it in the media, it's like people think that, okay, this is a philosophical question about like AI alignment. Like, how do we just get the AI to do what the human wants it to do? And how do we make sure that it's, you know, like nice and kind and do no evil and stuff like that? But then in the end, it's actually not so much a philosophical question, but it's actually a mathematical question. When you go actually deep there, you realize that there's actually deep mathematical dilemmas preventing us from designing models that can sort of like consistently behave the way humans want them to behave. It's actually a much harder question that I thought before I started actually reading about it.
That's a really interesting point. And building on what you said, for example, about the language generative solutions, I'd argue that it's also a bit of a cultural shift that's happening, or has started to happen now, especially at the end of 2022. Because I would argue that if we contrast the amount of AI publications and AI news presence machine learning has had over the past few years versus how visible it has been to the consumer, there's been a bit of a gap in between. Because if you are the consumer, you are not consuming, for example, Netflix's recommendation algorithm, you are just consuming Netflix as it is and getting recommendations recommended to you. So there's been this kind of a perception gap between where machine learning exists and where it is perceived from a consumer's perspective. But now, for example, as we start to discuss about generated graphics, we start discuss about in computer gaming about upscaled graphics through machine learning, we start discussing about using generative language solutions to create student essays and so forth, suddenly machine learning is in your face and it's real and it's comprehensible. It's tangible in itself. So it's going to be interesting to see how also the public perception, building on what you said, of the kind of where we are with these solutions is going to develop on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess that's why we even have this sort of a sci-fi literature as a phenomenon, that we need to prepare ourselves yeah. for what's to come.
Yeah.
But then the problem here with this time is that, you know, like, we have this science fiction saying that, okay, soon we'll be doing all this crazy stuff that no one thought was possible. And then, like, you know, like 10 years later, it's there. So it's the pace of change is just, you know, it's a funny joke saying that, okay, every single generation says that their time on Earth is specifically tedious and quick-paced and so on. But at least when it comes to the change that's happened with AI and how it affects our lives, it's certainly true that the change is vastly outpacing human ability to cope and get accustomed with the new reality. Of course, like I think overall, it's for consumer, it's going to be a pretty interesting thing. If you just like consume the value produced, it's going to be a huge bounty in so many ways. Not just like not just entertainment, but in so much more in many of those ways that actually define the value of life, the quality of life for humans. But then it's a totally different question when it comes to you as a professional. What's your role in being a valuable human being to others and making a living and so on? And that's the big source of question and challenge, which I don't think we actually know how to deal with that yet. Like we're really far from that.
Yeah.
Still at this point.
And to build on that, maybe if we retrospect for a while longer still and looking at 2022 and where we are right now, how do you see kind of the commercial or the organization level adoption? So you spoke about the maturation of methodologies such as computer vision, which then again are translatable to more robust solutions when it comes to practice. But for example, the report Nordic State of AI 2022 listed that around 70% of organizations interviewed had some form of machine learning now integrated into part of their ops. Are there specific trends or points of views that you've seen kind of from the commercial perspective about where we are standing with machine learning and its maturity today?
Well, I think what you mentioned is probably the most important one and the one that makes me happy, that usually you can split use of machine learning into two categories, where the category one is about using machine learning for decision support. So you have data, then you use algorithms to turn that data into some form of information, new type of information. And then you give it to humans to interpret and make something out of it, produce something valuable. And this is often actually quite valuable. This is a good way to get quick results because humans are good at taking in new information and making something out of it. But then there's always this challenge of, you know, insight. You know, the word insight is such a dangerous one that it's often thrown around without really asking the question like, okay, you're more insightful than 5 minutes ago, but why should anyone care about that? Like, what's different? Well, how does this bring value to anyone? So then there's the other category of use cases, which is about really automation, where you have data, you have machine learning turn that data into information, and then that information is automatically pushed to another set of machines that automatically do something out of it, make their own behavior more intelligent. And that, while that is vastly more difficult than the sort of decision support use cases, which also means that it takes much more time, more years before it actually starts like working in the real world, but that's the source of so much more value, where simply the sort of machine speed is letting us just do so much more things than if you have humans that sort of stop the flow of information in the middle. And, you know, in many cases, the machines need to sort of simplify the data, make it lose some of that information just so that humans are able to take it in and make something out of that. And that is actually like getting rid of that limitation is a big part of what deep learning is giving us and why it's been such a revolution. So every single time we've been doing these surveys, it's always been the way that that companies report that increasing amounts of them are using AI as part of their own product. So not just like using it for advanced analytics, where there's people looking at graphs and making hopefully smarter decisions based on that information, but actually basically having any product that is using electricity and costing $20, we are really nearing the point where anything matching those requirements is going to have machine learning running within it. Whether it's a microwave or whether it's your toothbrush, electric toothbrush naturally at your home, or the lighting in the office, that's feasible. There's actually business case there that you can produce value that is higher than the cost of that implementation, but it's just a question, do we have the people able to do all the work that we see in front of us?
That's a really interesting point of view. And using that as a segue to shift our focus into the future. So maybe even though we love to predict the future on inference, let's maybe first acknowledge that predicting the future is rather hard. But that said, as Silo is working at the front lines of AI adoption, it gives us a certain perspective to recurring themes that we can perhaps then infer on. So, Nico, building on what you just described from the democratization of integrated solutions as well as the technological maturity level, what is now in your horizon? So as we're entering 2023, what themes do you see becoming more relevant this year when we talk about, for example, production-grade AI?
There's quite a few, naturally, and it's probably going to be a really different type of a list depending on what is the industry you're working with. But perhaps one of the big shifts has been a reset of expectations, meaning that people are realizing that this isn't just going to be yet another technology wave. This is going to be a pretty big wave overall. And from there, maybe what follows is another trend in understanding the role of data. I mean, we've always understood the role of data overall, but nevertheless, we haven't really had a sort of a true engineering mindset towards how do we make sure that the big piles of AI models that we're soon going to be running as part of the company operations, they need a lot of data. How do we actually make sure that data is there and is as good as possible and we don't really break the bank while we're trying to make that happen? So these things come then in a totally new light when you start realizing the magnitude of the change. So you really need to take a step back and start thinking about it anew. And then maybe the third thing, this might show a bit of bias from my side in a way that this is something that is really interesting personally to me. And I think it's really showing up in increasing amounts all the time is how AI gets fused with other more traditional natural sciences and what's the result out from there. So that's like maybe the big third thing. But if I maybe start with the first one of the scale of the transformation. So just going back a few years back and the overall feel that you had in a lot of companies was that, you know, there's always these new technologies coming up. You read it from the newspaper and someone comes and says, yeah, we need that. And then you go and start making a roadmap and implement a bunch of things with the expectations that, okay, this will blow over. And in 5 years, there's going to be another hype, another technology. Then we'll just once again get on it and do that. And life will be marginally better. But now, during the past few years, there's been this big shift where more and more companies are realizing that this isn't going to be a five-year journey. And after 5 years, we'll have everything AI here and AI there, and we're all done with it. But rather, it's like it's not a five-year journey; it's a 20-year journey, and for many, it's going to be a 50-year journey. And overall, I've often been sort of like reflecting the state of AI right now to the state of aircraft in the 1920s, when you had the very first commercial airplanes taken into service. There was maybe one or two passengers, and it was pretty scary, you know. Those things didn't always stay on air flying as long as you would maybe hoped for. But still, it was actually a good business. It created something totally new that wasn't possible previously, and people loved it. And then it started growing. And then compared it to how things are nowadays, well, that's a big difference. The same goes for, let's say, if you have like first commercial computers from the 50s, when they were filling a whole room, if not a building. And there was like teams and teams of people just trying to make simple things happen. And then if you're thinking, well, what is the state of computers nowadays, where every single thing around us is full of computing units doing who knows what. And it's such a ubiquitous technology nowadays. So that's the shift that we're going to have with AI as well. Like right now, it's still like resource hungry, breaking all the time, doing stupid things, really expensive in every single imaginable way, but still doing a lot of really valuable stuff. And then if you think about, okay, where are we going to be with it 50 years from now? And that's what's like really now getting into the minds of people. Like we need to prepare for that. How do we prepare the company, not just for we need to implement what we already know, but we need to be able to stay with the pace of change, keep on learning, keep on implementing all the new stuff that constantly is coming up. So there's lots and lots more like fixed investments, lots like infrastructure investments, whether it's about expertise, competencies of individuals, of company personnel, whether it's about processes, how you do things, whether it's all the sort of basic data infrastructure that keeps on moving the data in a good quality throughout your computer systems. So you need much and much more focus on those things, so that it can sort of still keep on doing these investments in the future without like blowing your budgets on the way. So it's a lot about understanding that this will take a lot of money, keeping up with this transformation. So, and that means that you need to actually start thinking, are you efficient with those resources you have at hand? We've had quite a few examples of clients also like being maybe a bit too optimistic on how easy it is to scale AI operations, on developing new AI, putting that into production. But you actually need new thinking on how do you do it efficiently when companies move from having one model to 5 models, to 20 models, to 100 models, and from there on. That's a totally new type of mindset for many, and that's going on right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's actually ironic to hear you talk, because the way that I hear it is back in 2017, back in 2018, one of the largest themes used to be AI readiness. So what do organizations need to fundamentally do in order to start shifting themselves into the first adoption level that machine learning can start to come in and produce value? Essentially, this logic hasn't changed, just the scope of that is. And as I hear you talk about basically being ready to scale it up, but out also at the same time, I guess that brings all kinds of interesting infrastructure questions. And just out of curiosity, like when we talk about kind of what you see as the next logical growth paths when it comes to practical machine learning implementation. I suppose, you know, we can talk about like horizontal versus vertical scaling. So with vertical scaling, we could talk about building larger and larger critical systems where machine learning plays larger and larger role. And then you have the horizontal scaling, which is instead of opting for large scale solutions, you increase the number, the N of organization interfaces where these small value producing machine learning integrations have been created. So again, like if we take Netflix as an example, everyone of course knows Netflix through the recommendation system, which is kind of the flagship of where machine learning exists. But at the same time, the organization is famous for having 1,000 small scale implementations of machine learning across the whole production chain. So do you have a preference or point of view? Is there a specific theme that you see taking a bigger role when we go into 2023 on the vertical versus horizontal scale?
Not really, maybe, because it's so specific to each situation. So overall, whenever it's the same question gets placed with technology, there's like, if you try to put more different use cases and solve them from a single source, trying to do this sort of like a horizontal bundle of everything as a single solution, then it always slows things down. So when you do this horizontal accumulation of different use cases into a same bundle, it makes the whole harder to change. And as we know, the technology with AI it's constantly changing, meaning that when that change happens, it's probably going to take much more time for you to actually adapt to that. So there's that risk. Then the other question there is I really like actually this analogy, so I keep on using it many times, that in the 1950s, there was another, let's say, an AI. Probably it was rather a robot wave, robot hype that was ongoing back then. People thought that, okay, really, really soon we are going to have these household robots that will do everything for us at home. But that didn't really happen. But what did happen instead was that we got washing machines. And after that, you didn't have to do your laundry manually. Anyway, that was a huge thing. And now if you look around in your home, you don't have those sort of like do-it-all robots, but rather what you have a dishwasher, you have a microwave, you have a toaster, you have a blender. There's so many different appliances you have at home. And all of them are really specialized in one single individual use case. And why is that? It's simply because it would be prohibitively expensive to design, build, manufacture, and so on, a singular machine that could actually do it all. There's just so many different things that are unrelated that you would have to put into that same box. And the same goes for AI. Like, it would be prohibitively hard to create one single AI model that could solve a wide range of different problems that are unrelated to each other in a really, really strong manner. So instead of like having like this sort of like one generic AI, then we're going to rather have like big piles of individual AI models that are really, really good at the specific task at hand. One of them will be really good at creating virtual worlds for games. One of them will be really good at guiding lawyers to draft agreement texts. Another AI model will be really good at identifying flawed pharmaceutical products in a factory. But they will have very little to do with each other. And that's then the reason why in the end, this combination of having a sense of cost of implementation and being flexible to the future change, that will sort of mostly push the situation towards the setup where companies are not going to be building one single big monolith for AI, but rather designing their systems in a way that they are able to run lots and lots of them.
That's really interesting. And Nico, before you mentioned the not only the avalanche, for example, in the natural language processing data that we're actually getting available, but also kind of how we need to start thinking in a more of a data-centric, if you will, way when we think about machine learning implementation. So can you elaborate your thinking on this?
Yeah, I don't think it's really that original thinking overall. It's sort of repeating what I think has been the mantra of data scientists, well, as far as I've been involved in it. So it's a really long-standing talking point that when you build a machine learning model with some data, and then you see, okay, how does that model perform in the real world or some tests, whatever, how do you improve that? And then you have several avenues for that. Pretty often when you have data scientists thinking about that challenge, and they are the primary experts in solving that challenge, they are naturally rotating towards let's improve the model types of approaches, where it's sort of like, let's make the algorithm even more complex. Let's do like really, really smart things that I've been reading about in my university courses and thinking about in the late nights. Let's do those and see how much it improves. But then actually, in really, really many situations, that might be a useful way to do improvement. You will get some improvement in many cases, but that's not the most productive way. That's not the most efficient way of improving the results. So instead of trying to make models smarter, it's actually about, let's just get more data and improve the quality of data and push it through the same model, and then suddenly the results become even more better. And it's actually often a more scalable way of doing things, because the more complex the model is, there's more interesting ways it will blow up in the middle of the night. So you want to keep things simple, and the way to do that is often related to just having simpler models and pushing more good data through that. This also ties also this to this question that if you want to improve the overall intelligence of AI models, like deep learning models, having them more like human-like capabilities, is it the question of just let's put more data through it? Or is it about let's make a more complex algorithm? So this is the overall dilemma. Are you model-centric in your thinking, or are you data-centric in your thinking? And now I think overall for maybe many reasons, we're sort of reaching the point where the data-centric approach is actually gaining speed. We're starting to have the ways to think about it. We're starting to have tools to do something about it, to actually understand what is the valuable thing to do for a data set to improve the status quo of a model. And that also ties to this question that in many cases, you don't have to have all the data from the real world. We're increasingly having better ways to generate synthetic data that we can use to improve the model performance in sort of situations, for example, which we know that do exist, but are really hard to find in real-world data sets. How do we still make sure that the machine can learn about those? And in many other ways, how do we actually even discover the failure cases? Because as often with technology, it's one thing to make things 99% sure, and then it's a totally different thing to do it 99.9% successful. So we are just as an overall industry, as an overall field, AI is becoming much more capable in solving these questions, understanding these questions and solving them about what's the role of data, how should that role be augmented to improve the final results.
Interesting. And I suppose like if we take a look at the number of emerging startups in the machine learning toolkiting space, I suppose a large number of those companies are indeed focusing on data pipeline management tools, data monitoring solutions, annotation toolkits. So everything that has to do primarily with data and maybe secondarily as way of scaling up the modeling work in itself. Out of curiosity, like, how do you see this reflected in, for example, industrial roles? So over the past few years, as we've maybe gone from the first iterations into the first production grade systems, and now we're getting into the optimization and scaling out part, do you see that some specific roles will take a more centric role? Are there some roles that are maybe taking a step back?
The big challenge in industrial use cases, often with machine learning, is that the data is really unique. If you are solving use cases related to natural language, whether it's like, let's produce a human speech-based navigational system for some devices, and then alternatively, let's provide a speech assistant for disabled people, then in the end, both of those are taking advantage from this same core asset of human speech, which is more or less global in the end. It's a shared asset that we have. But then when you think about industrial use cases, then it's one thing to optimize the energy management of your car than it is to guide the arm of a drill machine within the mine. So the data is extremely specific to the use case. It's even specific to those individual sensors chosen. So even if a competitor company is doing the same use case, but they are using different sensors, the sensors are installed to a different angle as part of the product. They are doing different processing to the data in between. They have some other differences in so many different parts of the process happening to that data. All of those will sort of break the common aspects of these two contexts. So that's often a challenge for this sort of like data-related products and startups as well, that in a consumer world, many of the things are sort of shared. And you, once you build a model for one thing, then it's actually broadly applicable to many other things as well. But then in the industrial world, that's totally not the thing. Instead, over there, it's really about solving those problems, use cases, one by one. And those solutions will rhyme, but they are not the same. So that's a bit of a challenge overall, like how do you do scalable business in those areas?
Using that as a segue, the third theme that you raise up is AI for natural sciences and how kind of the boundaries are being reshaped on the technologies that we're working on. So again, can you elaborate your thinking around this theme?
Yeah, that's sort of like really exciting, because it's not just about, hey, we have an interesting research problem, let's solve that, or we have an interesting use case, and life will be marginally better for all of us if we do that. But I think how these two things, AI and natural science, how they tie together, is going to be like a hugely influential thing for us throughout centuries going forward. Like that's actually a thing that you would go back 1,000 years from now, read from the history books. What were the big sort of breaking points in the development of humankind and how we got everything working better? This was one of those. So in the end, like natural sciences, it's about the design and simulation and control of different natural phenomena, whether it's about electromagnetics, fluid dynamics, stress field, material, molecules, acoustics, how biology works, how cells and proteins work in depth, all of those things. And the biggest question, or one of the like significant challenge right now, is that we are running out of the smartness of the human brain. Like the challenges right now that we are trying to solve, let's say in biology, it's really hard to go forward in the science simply because the challenges are so complex that it's hard to have a single human brain to understand it all. And there comes the question that, okay, well, do we have another place where we can maybe download the problem into and have that make some sense out of it? And that's naturally where then AI and machine learning comes into question, that AI is basically designed to make sense of extremely messy situations, extremely messy data, and still figure out something useful out of that. And then what we're really seeing is that increasingly in many of these fields, whether it's physics research or whether it's pharma research, that increasing amount of those breakthroughs in these fields are coming from a really deep collaboration between those traditional scientists, let's call them that, and AI scientists. That's simply the way the science works nowadays. So, for example, with pharma research, there's been this sort of a phenomenon called Irum's Law, saying that as time goes by, it becomes exponentially more expensive to invent new drugs. And I would at least claim that there's quite a bit of things to do in drug research still. We're definitely not in an optimal state when it comes to healthcare overall as humans. But the challenge is that it's just way too expensive to do that. So at least I would wager and I would hope that really bringing in AI there will help us get rid of this problem, get rid of this exponential scaling of pharma research costs, and get us back to a stage that we had previously during the past century, where there was this sort of a renaissance of drug research, having huge amounts of new inventions coming up and human life improving in leaps and jumps all the way. So that's my hope that we have over there. And I think overall the science and the early commercial focus in this aspect is well, sort of proving my claim right, that's actually what's going on. So whether it's about pharma research or whether it's about having a better control of nuclear plasma in a fusion reactor, or designing like really deep optimization of chemical processes or totally new ways to communicate across radio signals, those things are getting totally overhauled right now with AI. So what from there will sort of happen is that pretty soon we're going to be in a state where a really big chunk of higher education for these traditional sciences is going to be focused on machine learning training, simply because that's the way you do top-end science nowadays. So it's not like you have AI people here and then you have physicists over there, but rather those physicists will have a really, really solid understanding of how machine learning could be helpful in the problems they are solving.
And that's really interesting because, like, for example, if we introspect with Silo a little bit, a large proportion of the people who ended up working at Silo actually used to come from the world of, for example, physics, where they started to apply this new toolkit to solve the core problem that they had in their very specific domain. And as a derivative, they happened to become the very experts of that toolkit in itself. But I suppose, like, this is a really interesting topic, and I suppose it comes kind of to, like, one point of view is also the criticality of the correctness of the information. So a Finnish company called Neural DSP, who was also a guest actually on Inference. So for those interested, please, I recommend go and revisit the episode. But Douglas Kasser of Neural DSP basically described the genesis of that company, which was the digital modeling of physical guitar and bass amplification, which is based on methodology called DSP, or digital signals processing. And the core problem of utilizing that technology to create high-scale solutions was simply the availability and the strain of that process. So in order for them, as I recall from the story, that Doc estimated that if they wanted to scale the process out, they would have had to hire every single DSP engineer in the world, and it still would not have been sufficient to tackle their level of quality. So like as a derivative, the only solution really that was left was to try out the last remaining solution, which was machine learning, or in other words, the replication or the reflection of the real world signal, as you know, throw a lot of high-quality training data on top of it and try to create this reflection about what the signal in reality would be. And, you know, the first expectation is that you get something that is inferior, but you get that in high scale. But actually, when you started to combine the machine learning paradigm with the DSP paradigm, so, you know, combining the best of both worlds, you actually ended up with an end product that was superior. But of course, like in this case, as we were talking about a consumer application, the implications of that were much different than, for example, what you, Nico, are referring to, for example, in drug discovery. But I suppose the paradigm is same. It's scaling out the problem solution to kind of get to that next plateau and then combining a mix of methodologies to kind of get it off from there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I mean, that's a really good sort of a practical example of what this means. Like I was talking a lot about science, but in the end it's engineering where science turns into something that's actually valuable to all of us. And we've had quite a few of these cases where actually the key to success is to go and sort of put machine learning, combine that with the traditional sciences. One example with a client was that they had an extremely sort of strong physics engineering team in place. And they'd been working on some problems for several decades, just improving the way, how do you model this physical phenomenon and turn that into value to clients and actually consumers as well. And then we sort of just like, we were mutually thinking about, okay, could we actually have AI help on this matter? Actually, funnily enough, there had been one DeepMind publication in this topic earlier, where they had been sort of giving a proof of concept that yes, this is sort of possible in sort of a related problem. And then we sort of went on to start figuring it out. How would it work in this situation? And in the end, it took us less than 6 months in a totally algorithmic level. So not maybe talking about final in production solution yet, but on an algorithmic level, in 6 months, we were able to produce a solution that was combining machine learning with physics that was clearly stronger than what they had been able to achieve with pure physics in 20 years. So that's the sort of like the scale of change that's happening there. And in the end, if you just think about like all the different like natural sciences and okay, what's the value of that? Like what's the value of quantum mechanics or all of these other like messy setups that we have? It's not that far removed from the world of the everyday consumer, because so many things actually that make our mobile phones work the way they do, they are based on quantum mechanics. They are based on relativity theory and all of this other stuff that we've been able to discover in sciences. So even if they sound like really complex and this doesn't concern me and so on, but it does. Like being able to improve the state of engineering with machine learning, it's really going to show up in our everyday life in the coming years.
And like for those working with implementation, this might be stating the obvious, but I kind of can emphasize the point that you just made enough, which was that when we talk about kind of the next generation of solutions applicability, it doesn't come just from the core methodology. It doesn't come just from machine learning. It's a hybrid in between, like getting a mix and match to reach that next level of elevation.
Yeah, there's like, I guess I could go on like quite a bit on like specifics, what that could mean. But it's really like, we've had like these comparisons, like, you know, like there's this one alternative, you just do pure science, like traditional science. And then there's one alternative that is doing pure machine learning. And both of those are like, okay, that doesn't really solve the thing. Like both of them are failing at it, but in different ways. And then it's a question, okay, how do we put these two things together so that we can, you know, combine those strengths that those two alternatives have, and then you end up with something magical. So it's exactly that way. Like, it's like, I would be the last person to sort of say that, okay, we're going to not need natural science expertise anymore, but it's just like you're going to have quite a bit like additional elements to it.
And going back to the point that you made before about the advancement of the processes and advancement of kind of the modern AI readiness, if you will, I suppose that becomes more and more prevalent, is how do we build the ways of working within our organizations where we can combine effectively the expertise of these two creeds, if you will, and better yet, create these hybrid experts that have like practical knowledge and know-how of the both worlds.
Yeah, and that then sort of comes back to the question that AI is a bit of a different animal than like, let's say, software and hardware has been. The one thing there is this dependence on data. If the data is different, then the outcome is going to be different. There's much more dependence there than we used to have, and that's driving this transition where you can't just solve the problem in a way that you have, let's say, like you're building a new product, new device, and you're building the hardware in one building, and then you have the software built in another building, and then finally comes the day of putting those two things together, and then over time it will actually work, and then you go and start selling the device to consumers. But there's going to be extra challenges, quite a few of them, when you have such a dependence on data that you actually have machine learning implementing many of those features in that product. And that means that there needs to be a totally new way of collaboration and communication between these different teams, whether it's the data team, the AI modeling team, the hardware team. How do you make the whole solution work in an optimal fashion? That requires a lot of understanding of what is actually making the AI solution fail in the midst of it, and how can all the different parts of the technology help in solving that problem. So that's the sort of like, we're heading there simply because so much of the competitive advantage in this modern products, so much of that competitive advantage is coming from machine learning-based features. That you know, like the next generation products, they are AI-driven. That's the mantra people keep on repeating, and that's the point. So if AI is the source of better products, then you sort of need to have expertise in the other areas of technology. They also need to be solving the problem that AI has in the middle. And that can't happen if you don't have the people understanding each other. So that's the big challenge that we're sort of after as well at Silo. Like we can't just not like say, okay, we'll do the AI bit if you do your bit. It doesn't work that way. Yeah. Like we actually need to have expertise in all the bits of the product. We need to understand how the hardware works. What does that mean when we are building the AI bits? How should we build the software around it once we know what the model is actually, how is it behaving, what are the problems it might have? So So this is the state we are in right now. And that's actually a big change that many companies are still maybe not really realizing how much it will actually mean to the way they design their work internally.
That's super interesting. We're starting to reach the end of the episode, but we'll need to do a follow-up on this. As a last thing, like typically at the end of Inference, we like to predict the future, but the problem is we've kind of done that already. So instead, I'd love to squeeze a request out of you, your request to organizations. So what is the one thing you'd hope to see companies actualize or deploy in their ways of working or thinking when it comes to AI adoption this year in 2023?
It's going to be about learning. Learning what AI is capable of and what would be the ideal ways for you to use it. And that's simply because AI is this new, really weird technology, and nobody really has a clue, like, what's going on. And even then, it's a really moving target. Like, you thought you knew about it a year ago, and then suddenly it doesn't really apply anymore to how things are nowadays. So that's like a compounded challenge that you have over there. So the question then is, like, how can you have this sort of a continuous learning, continuous ingestion at the whole organization level of what you could achieve with AI? Like, that's the, like, you know, like, that's one of the really early gates. If you want to be successful and create like new innovative products, not only during the next 5 years that you are thinking of right now, but if you want to do that also for the next 20 years as the underlying technology changes. So that's the big challenge. So how do you do that? And often it's like, okay, we'll just do a bunch of like AI trainings, like call everyone to this big conference hall and train on and send them off and say, okay, now we're done. But that's the one-off approach. Like, then things change, people forget, and then you're back to square zero. So instead, it's like, how do you do the continuous grassroots level of learning so that people actually start generating ideas? They start to have an intuition of how these new things work. How could I actually take advantage of that? And at least what we've had, like, what we have found useful is even in a stage where companies are not yet really working on AI-related projects because they are still trying to, you know, like, really polish the idea that they have about it. But there's a lot of other work ongoing in other, let's say, like more traditional engineering, more traditional data work, for example, there. But then if you have AI experts working side by side with the company's own people, then there's this like good opportunity for this AI knowledge to sort of transfer through personal osmosis from these AI experts to the other people, even when those projects they're working on are not directly AI related. So that's sort of bringing this like really big potential on a sort of like a free option basis, that then suddenly you are in much better situation to take advantage of not only the new technology, but also about this sort of new abilities of your own people that have suddenly appeared over there. So it's this broader learning. It's of course about turning new ideas into something useful, but it's also understanding more broadly, like, where the markets and your competitors might be going with AI. Like, people talk about AI disruption and like, okay, when are we going to end up in trouble? Like, what if someone else comes and implements something really cool that we couldn't think about? Well, this is sort of also the way to try and prevent that from happening when you have a really broad-based grassroots level of understanding of where things might go.
Nico, thank you so much for coming on Inference. And for anyone interested in following up and getting some more practical day-to-day learnings about the implementation of modern machine learning in practice, I recommend to everyone to go and visit the webinar we recently did with H&M and Oda, with Madeline Moritz from H&M and Jetil Omdalshevik from Oda, and of course, Nico Vuokko from Silo AI to get more of these insights. Nico, once again, this has been a tremendously insightful conversation. Thank you for coming on, and for anyone listening, have a great day.